After these things, Jesus and his disciples came into the land of Judea, and there he remained with them and baptized. Now John also was baptized in Aenon near Salim, because there was much water there, and they came and were baptized. For John had not yet been thrown into prison. Then there arose a dispute between some of John's disciples and the Jews about purification. And they came to John and said to him, Rabbi, he who was with you beyond the Jordan, to whom you have testified, behold, he is baptizing, and all are coming to him. John answered and said, A man can receive nothing unless it has been given to him from heaven. You yourselves bear me witness that I said, I am not the Christ, but I have been sent before him. He who has the bride is the bridegroom, but the friend of the bridegroom, who stands and hears him, rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is fulfilled. He must increase, but I must decrease. He who comes from above is above all. He who is of the earth is earthly and speaks of the earth. He who comes from heaven is above all. And what he has seen and heard, that he testifies, and no one receives his testimony. He who has received his testimony has certified that God is true. For he whom God has sent speaks the words of God, for God does not give the Spirit by measure. The Father loves the Son and has given all things into his hand. He who believes in the Son has everlasting life, and he who does not believe the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God abides on him.
My wife Mary and I, we met during our college years in the city of San Diego, and she went to college a mile or two from this location, and so San Diego has always had a very special place in our heart, and I have family in Southern California, so whenever we're down there, we try to break away and go to San Diego. And it's very romantic for us. It's nostalgic. It's beautiful. And we've never stayed at this hotel. It's called the La Valencia. We've never stayed there because it's a bit dear, right? I imagine. I don't know. But we always go and walk around that neighborhood because it's just, the vibe is so, it's dreamy. It's just, it's dreamy. It's beautiful and it's gorgeous. So, and I don't know about you, but that's our happy place. That's to me, that's perfection on earth, that area. And so I want you, for the purpose of our message today, to imagine with me that I'm super rich, like billionaire rich, and one of my kids is getting married, and we're having a destination wedding. Okay? And I want to invite you all to come to this destination wedding, and it's going to be in San Diego at the La Valencia Hotel. It's going to be 2 weeks, all expenses paid. We're going to send a limousine to your house to pick you up, take you to the airport, fly you first class to San Diego, where another limousine will pick you up and deliver you to the La Valencia. You can pack a toothbrush, whatever, but you're going to get an expense account while you're there. All your meals are paid for, all your clothing, and there's in this area where this hotel is, it's kind of like the Rodeo Drive of San Diego. So you can go shopping, get whatever you need, and every night we're going to have your favorite bands, the best food, we're going to do trips to Mexico, we're going to go deep sea fishing, there's sailing, there's diving, there's snorkeling, there's beachcombing, there's everything, besides the wedding, right? It's going to be a great time.
I guess.
And so hopefully you'll, and if you say, I can't take the time off work, I say, what would you make during that time? Well, it's covered. It's, you don't know, there's no worries. It's all covered. All you have to do is say, yes, I'll go. And so we go and we have a great time. You say, well, what does that have to do with the passage today? Has everything to do with it. Because in the passage today, we're invited to a wedding. And it's better than what I just described. You're the center of the wedding. You're the one being proposed to by the most beautiful groom in the history of the world. Look at your outline with me, and you'll see that there's these three big sections of the passage. And the first section is a mistrust. And this is where the disciples of John the Baptizer are noticing, they've been in an argument with a Jewish leader about baptism, and they're noticing that Jesus is getting more converts, more people are coming to Jesus. He's baptizing more than John the Baptizer is. How does that happen? And they're jealous, and they're upset. And so the disciples of John the Baptizer come to John and they say, what's going on? And look at the last verse there in that section. Everyone is going to him. To who? To Jesus. And they're upset because they're losing some of their play in the game. And they're jealous of Jesus. So there's a mistrust. And this mistrust is what sets up the teaching about marriage that John the Baptizer gives. And that teaching is in the second section, where it says a marriage. John responds to them and he says, hey, listen, I'm not the groom, okay? I'm not the center of attention. Jesus is the groom. Jesus is the center of attention. You're focused on me and you're focused on the wrong person because Jesus is the center of attention. He's the one you should be focused on. And you shouldn't be jealous that he is at his time of his wedding, that everyone's looking at him. And then he goes on in the third section where it says a mate. And when it says mate, we're not talking about like the way maybe an Australian would say, oh, he's my mate. We're talking about this groom, this marriage partner that is inviting you to marry him. He talks about it in this verse. He tells you a little bit about this person that is proposing to you. So that's the big overview of the passage. So let's start in the first section, if we will, where it says a mistrust. And like I said, the disciples of John the Baptizer have gone to John and they're saying, we're not sure what to do. And I don't know if you know it or not, but Jesus' ministry is increasing and it looks like yours is decreasing. And we're worried that giving is down, numbers are down, baptisms are down. And we're in this argument with this Jewish guy, and he says we're all messed up, and we don't like what's going on. We're not the most popular act in town anymore. And they're jealous, and I identify with them. I get them. I understand them. And if you're going to understand this section of the passage, you have to be able to answer this question. Of whom and or what are you most jealous? Who do you envy? Who do you wish you were more like? Who do you see prospering or succeeding? And it kind of bugs you because you realize you're losing when they're winning. And I have to confess to you that envy or jealousy is one of my besetting sins. My wife knows about this very well. I talk to her about it all the time. But I have a problem with this. And it's kind of serious because when you read in the New Testament about envy, it's in all the lists of sins with the really like bank robbers and child molesters and then the envious. You know, and it's like, I'm in that list. That's me. I have this problem. And I have it in the regular American way. We're trained and taught to envy each other. And I have it that way. I remember the first time I was really envious, there was this guy in high school, and I wanted to be him. He lived in the perfect place, you know, on the beach, super rich family. He had a brand new Italian sports car convertible. And when he would pull into school in this Alfa Romeo, you know, and it was just like, wow. And he was talented. He was a great athlete. He was good looking. He had the best clothes. And he had the girl that I wanted. And so it was just like, wow. So I have that kind of envy, just the regular run-of-the-mill envy. But I have it worse than that because I have it kind of like is in this passage. And I think, I don't know, the Bible doesn't say which one is worse, but I think it's probably worse. I have religious envy. And that's what we see here is you've got these three religious groups. You have the Jewish group. And they're fighting for their turf because Jesus is imposing upon their turf. And they're upset because not only Jesus, but then John the Baptizer and his clique is over here, and they're imposing on the Jewish turf. So they're upset about that. And then you got John the Baptizer's guys, and they see that their movement is in decline, and they're upset about that. So they're jealous of the Jewish people and of the Jesus people. Then you have the Jesus people, and they're in the middle fighting both of these groups. They're not fighting, but they're competing for disciples. This is religious competition. This is religious envy. And I have it bad. I have it really bad. I envy you musicians up here. I really do. I love to worship with you. I really do. But I watch you and I just go, I wish I had this much, you know, of that talent. I really do. And I don't. But I envy you. I really do. And I don't mean it in a bad way, like I hate you, I want to hurt you. I don't mean that. I just like, oh, I wish, you know. I envy other ministers, other speakers. I hear them and I go, wow, I wish I could communicate like that. Or I was just telling Mary this morning about a guy I saw on YouTube yesterday, Christian guy, young guy. He lived for the devil all his life. And then just a couple years ago, the Lord saved him, and now he has this huge international ministry. And I'm like, that's not fair. How come God gave him that when I have worked so hard, you know? God's blessing the wrong guy. Right, so I have this religious envy. It's bad. It's worse. It's a sin. So I want to ask you this. If you have jealousy or envy, maybe it's material, maybe you're envious of someone's looks or appearance or money or position of power, education, whatever it is, what is that? And then I'm going to ask you this. How do you treat that? What do you do with that? What are you doing now to deal with that issue in your life? And some of us have it even worse than I'm describing. Some of us are angry at God because we want to have someone else's gender. We want to have someone else's race. We want to have someone else's parentage. We want to have someone else's intelligence quotient. We want to have someone else's looks. These are things we cannot change with time, money, effort, work, anything. These are just things that God has given to us. And we say, God, I'm jealous of the other that you gave to them, and I want it. That's kind of messed up too, isn't it? So if you have any of these issues, what are you doing to treat it? And we'll see in the passage some way, at least one way to approach it. And then think about this passage and the conflict between these three groups and ask yourself this, which group do you most identify with? There's the Jesus group, and Jesus is calling us to a relationship. He's calling us to a marriage. It's very personal. It's very intimate. And then there is the reform movement led by a prophet, and that's John the Baptizer. And he is saying, I'm a Jewish prophet, and I believe in God, and I believe in Judaism, but I'm reforming it in a certain way, and people are following John, not Judaism itself. And then there's the pure form of religion. In this case, it's Judaism. And all of us, and I say, I don't mean just us, I mean society, America, the world, we're doing one of these three things. We're in one of these three camps. We're trying to follow a pure religion that's been written down for us, or we're following a reform movement of that religion that's led by a prophet or prophets that's interpreting that religion to us, or we're following Jesus. And here John the Baptizer invites us to follow and fall in love with Jesus. So look at the second section, a marriage. And the metaphor is pretty straightforward. It's John the Baptizer is saying, I am the best man. We would say in our language, best man. He would say, I am not the groom. I'm not the guy getting married. I'm not the center of attention. I'm the best man. Now, in our culture, when there's a wedding, who is all the focus on? The bride. And so this is a different approach. This is a different culture. This is a different orientation. And he's saying, you need to focus on the groom. And I'm not the groom. I'm the man. I'm the guy who stands by the groom. And it's totally different. But I understand the metaphor. He's saying, Jesus is inviting you to be married to him. And I am pointing you, I'm the matchmaker, pointing you to the groom and saying, you be with him. Don't be with me, be with him. I get that. And if you look at the bottom of the section here, I put in the fine print 6 or 8 or 10 or 12, I don't know, how many passages that describe this metaphor for us in other language and other places and other contexts. It runs from the book of Genesis through the book of Revelation. This metaphor that John the Baptizer uses that says, Jesus wants to get with you. Jesus wants to marry you. Jesus wants to be with you. Jesus is inviting you to intimacy with him forever. And this metaphor just keeps springing up. I get the metaphor. I understand the metaphor. I believe the metaphor, like you were saying at the beginning. But I don't believe it in my... I believe it in my brain. I don't believe it in my soul. And here's the problem I have. I don't believe anyone loves me that much. I really don't. Got this guy, he's on one knee, he's giving me the ring, he says, I want to marry you. He says, I live in the penthouse, the La Valencia Hotel, I drive around town in a Bentley, and I want to marry you. It's like, no, you don't, no you don't. You don't want to marry me. No. I'm not good enough for you. I'm not sophisticated enough for you. I'm not beautiful enough for you. I'm not smart enough for you. You don't want to be with me. He's like, yeah, I do. And I don't believe him. So part of the work for me as I've studied this passage has been to talk to God about this and say, do I really believe that you love me this much? And the answer is no, I don't. So what am I going to do? And so I've been trying to not just understand the passage and what it says, but I've been trying to feel the feelings and say, okay, I accept this love. I accept this invitation. I really want to believe that you are crazy about me, that you're infatuated with me, that you're in love with me, that you... there's a sense in which you lust after me and you want me, that I am more loved than I can understand. And that's challenging for me. That's hard for me, but I'm working on that. Now, you remember I asked before, what's the cure for jealousy? And part of it is in this second section here. John the Baptizer says he must increase and I must decrease. And the reason why John the Baptizer is able to look at the success of Jesus and not be jealous like his followers are is because he loves his cousin Jesus. He loves Jesus. And what happens when someone that you love gets something good? You're excited for them. If one of your kids won the lottery or something, they got some great honor, you're delighted for them. You're You're over the moon. You're so happy for them. But if that neighbor that you hate wins the lottery, right? And what's the difference? The difference is love. Because what does it say in Corinthians? Love does not envy. And so when I'm envious, I'm saying to myself and to you and everyone else, it's like, I love myself more than I love God. I love myself more than I love you. I love myself more than I love the thing or the place. And Mary and I were talking about something totally different about a week ago. And she said to me once, you know, she says, when we first got married, it was kind of the George show. That hurt. It really hurt. And I said, you're right. It really was, you know. Why? Because I loved myself and my focus was on myself. And that's the second thing here. What's the cure for jealousy, envy, and competitiveness? The first is love. And the second is focus. Who am I focused on? And the disciples of John the Baptizer were saying, my focus is on us, our team, our clique, our denomination, our group, our church, our work, our ministry. We're focused on this. And John says, you need to open your focus and you need to focus not on yourselves or on us, but on him. And the third thing that he gives as a solution to this is in verse 27. John responded, no one can receive anything unless it has been given to him from heaven. And so the third way John the Baptizer deals with envy is with acceptance. He accepts, this is who God made me. Now, we know about John the Baptizer. Dude was weird, right? He looked funny. He ate funny. He acted weird. And he lives in the desert. You know, and if you're going to put it on paper, you know, create a religious movement, these are not the elements or the qualities that you would put on your list. But he accepts, this is who I am. This is how God's made me. This is the job that he's given me to do. And he sees his ministry is in decline. He's losing converts and the people are going to Jesus. And he's okay with it. He accepts it because he says, this is what God has given me to do. God has made me the best man. I stand by the groom. I'm not the groom. And so part of learning to deal with my jealousy is to accept the gifts in the place that God has put me. And I'm working on it. Now I want you to think about the marriage again. And this is partly comical and partly just really serious too. I want you to think about the ways that you're ruining the wedding. So imagine if you come with us to the wedding, you know, in San Diego, and maybe you have been to these weddings where you've seen this happen. I certainly have. And maybe you've seen them on YouTube or videos and things where you're at the wedding and someone is there that's like everyone's supposed to be focused on the bride and the groom, and they dress in such a way to draw a lot of attention to themselves, and you're like, no, don't wear that. No, don't do that. But they do. Why? Because they want to get focus on them. Or you go and you see the ones where they're at the reception and everyone's dancing and the bride and the groom are in tight like this, you know, doing their little thing. And then there's this person that's just dancing, that's just flailing all over the place. Why? To draw attention to themselves. So what ways are you dressing or dancing or behaving that's drawing attention away or focus away from the groom? The other one is the funniest one that I've seen is this girl is, it's a video of this girl who's at the wedding. She's dressed inappropriately. She's had way too much to drink. She's dancing erratically, crazily. And in her condition, they're in this one of these wedding tents, you know, the white tent with the poles and everything. She kind of slips and grabs hold of one of the poles and down she goes and the whole tent falls on top of them all, and she ruins the wedding. Why? Because she didn't love the groom. She's focused on herself, and she doesn't accept her place in the marriage, in the wedding. So what ways are you doing that? Another thing that I see happening, and it happens in the church, it happens outside the church too, it's very popular to criticize the bride and the groom. Now, in our scenario here, or in life, if you go to a wedding and you criticize the groom, like, okay, like, that's bad, don't do it, but he can take it, right? But you go to a wedding, or you come to my kid's wedding, and you criticize the bride, well, them's fighting words, you know what I'm saying? I'm going to send the groomsmen after you, right? You don't do that. But people do it all the time. They call the bride all sorts of nasty names. And then they say things that are totally inappropriate to her and make advances towards her. No. You don't do that. And then when they do that, they read verse 36 and they say, I don't understand the wrath that I'm getting back from God. I don't understand. And it's like, well, it's because you didn't understand, because you don't do that. So in what ways am I ruining the wedding by acting out selfishly? And then again, and we talked about this before, what is my core identity? Do I identify as the bride? Do I accept this position that Ephesians gives me? That all of the Pauline, the pastoral letters give me, that Isaiah gives me, that the prophets give me. Do I accept my position as the bride? That he loves me this much? And that he wants this with me? What's my core identity? And if you say, I can't go there. I can't see myself in this role as the bride at this glorious wedding in this most romantic and perfect of settings. If you say, okay. And I ask this to secular people as well. It's like, what metaphor do you use then to describe your life? It's very important. Whether you're an atheist or Christian or whatever, what metaphor is it that describes your life? So we have this mistrust, the jealousy. We have the description of the marriage and that the groom is the center of attention and he must increase. And John the Baptizer says, I must decrease. And then we have a description of the mate. And I think what this is John's way of trying to say, you're being invited to this marriage, to this person whose name is Jesus. And he's proposing to you. Who is he? And so in his own very mystical, detailed way, he gives a description of who he is. He says he's above all, which means he has a perspective that's different than all of ours. The one who's from the earth, John was from the earth, is earthly and speaks in earthly terms. And all religions come from this earth. But the one who comes from heaven, Jesus, is above all. He's heavenly. And we might say in the language of the metaphor today, he's dreamy. He's dreamy. He has a totally different orientation, perspective, distance than anyone you've ever met before. And then it says in verse 32, he testifies to what he has seen and heard. So probably some of you have not been to this hotel we saw in the video. But if you want to know about that neighborhood or that area, you could come and talk to me and I could tell you about it. Why? Because I would tell you about what I have seen and heard. Or if I wanted to go to Romania or someplace far away that I've never been, and you said, I speak Romanian, I'm from Romania, I'd say, well, I want to go there. Can you tell me about it? And you would say, well, yeah, I grew up there. You know, I know it. And John the Baptizer is saying, Jesus knows about heaven because he comes from there. It's his village. And his dad's the mayor, and he knows, and he speaks the language. He has a different perspective, comes from a different place, and you can trust him because he knows this. So we had Resurrection Sunday last week, and a lot of scoffers and people who don't believe say, Jesus didn't rise from the dead. You can't believe that. There's no proof. That's silly. It's a fable. And I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine here in Portland not long ago, and he was saying just that kind of a thing. You know, no one has been to the other side. When you die, no one knows what's happening. You can't trust anyone or any religion or any religious book to tell you that. And I said, are you sure? He's like, I'm sure. I said, really, are you sure of that? He's like, I know that. I said, have you read what Jesus says about this? I think so. It's like, well, really, have you? Because you have right here, he's saying, when I tell you about the other side, I'm not creating a vision of a place I don't know. It's my hometown. It's where I come from. And so this man, this groom who's proposing to us, comes from heaven. And he speaks about what he has seen and what he has heard. And even though he knows this, he's misunderstood. And a lot of people don't accept his invitation to marriage. It says in verse 33, the one who has accepted his testimony has affirmed that God is true. He claims to be the truth. And he speaks the words of God. So not only is he true, he's saying, when I talk, you're hearing the echo of God. And we can trust everything he says. And he's spiritually generous. He gives the Spirit without measure. He's, you know, I'm presenting this picture where I'm, you know, offering you this trip because I'm generous. Well, he's generous, spiritually generous beyond our wildest comprehension. It says in verse 35 that he is loved by the Father. Not only is he in this elevated stature, perspective, he has a Father who's bigger and better and loves him. He knows what it is to be loved, and he can give you that love. And his Father is rich, and he can give you those riches. It says in verse 36, the one who believes in the Son has eternal life. He is eternal. He gives life. And all you have to do to accept the invitation, to accept the proposal to marriage, is to believe that what he says about himself, it's all true. It's all true. And he wants you. And this leads us to the last verse. The one who believes in the Son has eternal life. The one who rejects the Son. So Jesus is down on the one knee with the little box, you know, with the ring in it. And he's saying, I want to marry you. The one who rejects the Son will not see life. So if I say to you, I have the tickets, you know, here's a box. I don't have a box. Here's the box with all the tickets. And this is your card and your credit cards and all the stuff for this big trip we're going to. Just come and get it. And you say, no, I don't want it. Right? I won't take it. It's like, okay, all right. So then what happens, and when we fly down there, by the way, we're not flying United. We're not flying American. We're flying Alaska Airlines. But let's say you go, you couldn't resist. But let's say you go to the airport. You go to the airport and you say, I changed my mind. I want to go to the wedding. Let me on the plane. I don't care if it's Alaska Airlines. They're not letting you on the plane. Why? Because you didn't accept the ticket. You say, I don't understand. And they say, I'm getting on that plane. And they say, we're calling the marshals. You're not getting on the plane. We're not going anywhere. And then what do we say? How rude, how cruel, how inequitable. I can't believe I'm being treated like this. And the response is, you rejected the ticket. You rejected the ticket.
Free will?
Yes. And so everyone says, this is terrible that God does this. And I want to turn the tables on you or on the person that's thinking like that and say, you're saying that there's something wrong with the character of God because he won't let you on the plane or into the wedding if you're not dressed properly for it and you haven't accepted the invitation? Let me turn it around and say, let's think of it this way. What does it say about the character of a person who rejects such a generous invitation? The onus, the guilt is not on God, it's on us. It's on us. So why would you reject him? And it makes no sense. There's no reason to reject him. Mary and I have a friend who's recently married and a lovely person. And she struggled for the longest time because this guy that had proposed to her, Mary said that I had a bromance with him. And I did. I just thought he was the greatest guy in all the world. And when I met him and got to know him, and he was chasing this girl that we know. I was saying to her, it's like, go with him, you know. This guy's great. He's just the best. He's just everything. I can't imagine, you know, how could you create a more perfect man? Go with him. And she was afraid and didn't know. But here's Jesus coming along, and he's offering you eternal life. And John says how beautiful he is and how glorious he is. Why would anyone reject him? But some of us do. Before you turn your outline over, look at the big idea at the top. The big idea today is that Jesus is in love with me and that he offers me everything. That's the big idea today. He's in love with me and he wants to marry me. Now you can turn your outline over and look at the review section there. And as we've thought about this passage, the conflict at the beginning, the disciples of John the Baptizer, my problem is I'm selfish. I'm self-focused. I can be narcissistic. I have a problem. Because I'm focused on myself and I love myself, I tend to be jealous and envy other people, whether it's materially or religiously, some other way. That's my problem. But I can accept the love of God, the love of Jesus, and enter into the marriage metaphor and increase my focus on Jesus. I have the capability to say it's not about me. Even though I'm the bride, in the Jewish context, the focus isn't on me, the focus is on the groom. And I'm going to seek to submit to that metaphor and put the focus on him. I can do that. I can enter into the marriage metaphor. And I'm being invited by Jesus to do that, or by John the Baptizer to do that. And then in the third section, worship is retelling Jesus' beauty. What he does in that third section, he says, listen to the qualifications of the man, the groom, who's inviting you to marry him. I can worship him by retelling his beauty. And it says, just believe that this is the one, that he is all of these things. I worship him by believing that he's all he says about himself and that I am all he says is true about me. I want to ask the tech guys to put a photo up here. There we go. This is a picture from the Hotel La Valencia. And don't get me started. I love that place. I don't want to turn away. This is an invitation. We're going to close with an invitation. At the beginning, I gave you this invitation to this destination wedding in San Diego at the La Valencia Hotel. And as we've looked at this passage in John 3, you are being given an invitation. And I wrote down here the invitation in the first person. And the first bit is in verse 36. I don't want to reject the invitation. I want to receive this invitation. I want to accept that I am so loved by him, even though that's challenging and difficult for me. I want to not reject the offer. So the invitation to you is, don't reject the offer. Accept the offer. Accept the invitation. I want to believe that Jesus is the Son of God. I want to believe that he's this dreamy groom and he's everything and all that he's presented to me as being. And I want to accept Jesus' love and his marriage proposal to me. So the invitation to you is to accept this proposal to marriage, to live with him, to be with him, and to receive this love and to love him back by believing that he's all that he says he is. Let's pray together. God, I thank you for your patience with me. I thank you that you know my pride and my selfishness, my jealousy, my envy. And in the midst of that, you still love me. You still approach me. You still woo me. You still invite me to participate with you to be intimate with you. God, I thank you for that, and I ask you to help me to believe and to receive all that you are for me, to not reject your love, but to accept it. And we worship you for your qualities and who you are. Amen.